weeknights from 6
on 2FM.
Thanks to Betty De Silva for taking us through the afternoon here on 2FM. It's Tuesday the 17th of September and you're listening to Game On. Coming up between now and the new music show with Dermot O'Brien at 7 o'clock, the Champions League is back. But not as we know it. Paul Corrie and Mark Langdon are standing by to discuss match day one with Aston Villa already in action. In rugby, Neil Tracy has the latest as Simon Easterby takes over from Andy Farrell for now. Plus, Munster named Tadhg Byrne as captain and Ireland named their squad for the WXV series. Plus, in boxing, Celtic heavyweight champ Thomas Carty is with us before Friday's fight to talk ambition, patience and sparring with Tyson Fury. If you want to have your say, you can text us on 51552, WhatsApp us on 087 187 9200 and on X, we're at Game On 2FM.
Game On 2FM.
Welcome along. Paul Corrie is with me in studio. Rubio is here as he always is on a Tuesday. And we have some breaking news to start with. The takeover has been agreed for Dundalk Football Club. They have tweeted that they are delighted to announce that a takeover of the club was agreed between Brian Ainscough and Dundalk native John Temple. We'll be speaking to Tony O'Donoghue about this in a while and we have all the details from him. But from the offset or the outside, I guess, Paul, it is good news that the club looks like it's been saved. We'll get some details in a while, though.
It's a massive relief, to be honest with you, Marie. Not only for Dundalk, but for the whole league. It would have been a terrible look. I mean, it was very worrying, wasn't it? Kind of Sunday night, Monday morning, it seemed like there was a real tight deadline. And if they weren't able to secure a new ownership, that the club might actually fold. And what a tragic story that would have been for kind of the leading light of Irish football for so long and doing so well in European competitions to actually fold. And you would still be very worried, I think, about the gross mismanagement of that club over the last number of years. I don't think we can get away from that, but it is a relief that John Temple has come in and rescued the club. Be interesting to hear what his plans are. Is this, you know, a short term plan to get them to the end of the season, or does he see a plan, I guess, beyond the end of the season and into the beginning of next season? But it's a major, major relief for everybody associated with the league.
Paul, you want to see the face on Shane Dawson last night. Is he worried or thought about Shells losing X amount of points and what that would do for the league? And that would have been a real shambles.
Yeah, it would have been. It actually would have changed the league table substantially. Like, Derry would have been top of the league, would have brought Shamrock Rovers right back into things. I think St. Pat's would have benefited as well because they've dropped points from Dundalk, and it would have actually made a bit of a shambles of the league table. I think you're right, Ruby. So it'll be good that whoever does win the league will win it by completing all 36 games and having points associated with 36 games to their name. So yeah, it's a major relief, but I still think, I was listening to Alan last night, you know, the fact that the due diligence wasn't really done on the new ownership that came into Dundalk, I think that has to be a worry. But also, you know, like, we were talking about Dundalk a couple of years back being the likes of, you know, Rosenberg during their period of dominance, and Dundalk were going to dominate for the next 10-15 years because of the resources that they were able to lean on because of how well they'd done in Europe. Like, they're sitting bottom of the table now, and to nearly fold, I think, is something that we just can't get away from.
Haven't pushed on in terms of the grounds, the development, what needs to be done to attract players, all that sort of stuff.
It's worrying that they've probably brought in so much revenue from European competitions and still have the same stadium. You know, very little has been put into that club. Yes, I know there's some training facilities and maybe meeting rooms and weight facilities, but, you know, the majority of the infrastructure remains the same, and it's not good.
And also, can we sit here and say it's never going to happen again?
No. It's happened so many times before and we're faced with a situation where one of the biggest clubs over the last number of years has found itself in a similar situation to clubs gone by. So it's worrying, and I guess it gives ammunition to people who feel that football shouldn't be given funding from government. Mm-hmm. And that would be the big worry.
Well, I think that's too narrow a way of looking at it. But what about from the outside looking in? When you look at so many clubs under financial pressure, Dundalk being the latest one, the ones that have folded before, it's not exactly an advertisement for people to invest in it, is it?
No, and I guess that goes for any football club. You look at the top clubs around Europe and the losses that they're making is staggering, some of the numbers that they're putting up. But yeah, that the same is true with some of the top clubs in the League of Ireland. I know, you know, some of the teams up the top end of the league at the moment, had they not, let's say, done well in European competitions this year, may have had to cut back massively on budgets. And you do hear about some of the wages, Ruby, that are actually being thrown around the league at the moment, and they are multiples of what was offered when I was around.
It was described as an arms race.
It's pretty mental, some of the wages that are going around. And the reason I say that is there's players who will come back from the UK and are being offered, let's just take 1,500 or 2 grand a week as an example. They wouldn't get that on offer in the UK. Like, there's no clubs who'd be willing to pay them that amount of money in League One or League Two. So why are clubs in Ireland throwing the money at those players to bring them in? Yes, okay, I understand to try get European football and the short-term focus, but the long-term focus is that it puts massive pressure on clubs' finances.
Is that what the big attraction is, though? Because it's a league where the winners change, okay, not in the last few years, but like there is opportunity for people to build squads and get into Europe and then be at the receiving end of all that cash if they can get there.
Yeah, well, you only have to look if, let's say, for instance, one of the top three teams in the league actually wins the FA Cup. That means that there's four places up for grabs each year in European football. That's 40% of the league get European football. Yes, it might only be one or two rounds, but the monies that are on offer at the moment are just incredible. And St. Pat's and Shamrock Rovers will have benefited hugely from the results they got and the rounds they played in Europe this year. Shamrock Rovers will obviously go on and play the Conference League group stages, and that gives them huge resources then to reinvest back into the club and back into the playing squad. If they didn't make the group stage of the Conference League this year, their squad was going to have to be trimmed substantially because they wouldn't have been able to keep up the wages that they're paying out.
The risk is huge, Paul.
It is. It's huge. It's absolutely massive. And that's why, let's say, any funding that we get from government has to go into the infrastructure and the facilities. Players and managers will come and go. They'll, you know, hoover up whatever wages they're given. But the facilities are the thing that are going to remain. And that's going to be the bedrock and the foundation of Irish football. You need to give the kids the right facilities, the right coaches and the right contact hours if you want to develop players within this country. If you don't do that, expect the senior results to remain the same.
It's simple. So grim, isn't it?
It is so grim, but we have stood still for so long while the rest of European football has progressed with facilities and coaching and progression of the game. Our methodology never worked in the sense that we just export our talent to the UK. 14, 15 year olds, I think it's bananas what we were doing, hoping that they would succeed over there. And for the ones who didn't, there was very little pathways for them. The pathways are better at the moment, but there's still a huge amount of work that needs to be done on the foundations of the game to actually give kids the best chance of having a career within it.
Okay, well, look, I think there's a lot more to explore there, but now we're going to do a crossover to Tony O'Donoghue, who's going to bring us the latest on the Dundalk takeover. So, Tony, how did they get to this stage?
Well, through a lot of negotiation. We saw yesterday that there was a huge concern that the club might be liquidated. A meeting of supporters yesterday to show solidarity and support. In the background, the owner, Brian Ainscough, was based in Boston, of course, still. And when I spoke to him yesterday, he was on Zoom calls with various investors, but it turned out to be only one investor in the end. John Temple was the sole party who got to the latter stages, if you like, of the deal. And it looks as if a deal has been done. John Temple has already been quoted by the club as saying he understands how important and hugely important the club was to the community and to the supporters and the people of Dundalk, and we saw that yesterday. And he said he appreciated the concerns of people who felt that the club was that close to going out of business. So a preferred consortium will take on the 80% owned by Brian Ainscough, and the other 20% will be four minority investors. So it was right through the night. Obviously, there's a time zone issue with Brian Ainscough being in Boston, but the deal has gone through, and it's John Temple leading a consortium of investors who will underwrite players' wages, I understand, and examine the viability for the club going forward. Now, we did think that there may be a question of Dundalk having to go into what they call SCARP, which is a small companies administration rescue package. I understand there's no immediate plans to enter that at the moment, so it looks as if this consortium will take on all the legacy debts, and the new owners will apply for a licence to compete in 2025 without the hindrance of a points deduction. Because if they had gone into a form of administration, there would have been a points deduction. So that means that John Daly's team can give themselves a fighting chance of not finishing bottom of the table, of getting to the playoff spots. Now, that'll be tough because they've lost their last three. They're a point behind Drogheda. But there is hope, and maybe what's happened, the drama, I suppose, over the last 24 hours, the fact that the fans showed once again how much the club means to them, maybe that can inspire the players and make for an absolutely great escape.
Tony, you said something there. Examine the viability of the club going forward. Can the club be made viable?
You'd like to think so, Ruby, because, you know, it does have magnificent history in an Irish context, the second most successful club, 14 league titles, 12 FAI Cups. But yet, with all the recent history and recent success, particularly under Stephen Kenny, and the millions that was, you know, received from participation in European competitions and getting to the group stages twice, Oriel Park, and I was up there all day yesterday, is still hardly fit for purpose. The pitch isn't good enough. The lighting isn't good enough. There's hardly been a lick of paint in the place. Now, the announcement yesterday by the Minister, Thomas Byrne, that almost all of the grant, if not all, that had Dundalk applied for to, you know, improve the pitch and the other facilities will be granted. I think that helped the process a little bit in giving comfort to the new investors. Although, of course, that money can only be used for infrastructural reasons. It couldn't be used to pay players, for example. But going forward, you'd like to think it would be an absolute tragedy in a sporting context if Dundalk FC was to go out of football. And, you know, there wouldn't be a Phoenix-like club that could come back in its place and just, you know, lose all the debts and leave the creditors in the lurch. That wouldn't be possible this time around. It's happened in other scenarios in Irish football, but to lose Dundalk would be a sporting tragedy, and hopefully that can be that reality is not going to come to pass.
And Tony, do we know much about John Temple?
He was involved, I understand. Yeah, a barrister that was involved in trying to take over the club in the past. It wasn't successful when, in fact, Brian Ainscough took over. Now, what's important from the FAI's point of view is that they conduct their licensing, fit and proper person, do all their checks and balances to make sure that this sort of thing doesn't happen again. Because, you know, it's really embarrassing. And as they more or less accepted at the AGM at the weekend, you know, basically they admitted that a more robust level of financial due diligence should have been carried out when the club moved from the ownership of Stat Sports and Andy Connolly over to Brian Ainscough, because it only happened late in December 2023. So this time around, all the checks and balances will have to be in place, because it wouldn't be just embarrassing. It would be ridiculous if new owners were to come in and the same thing were to happen again. So hopefully it's good news. I understand there is a meeting of the 1903, the supporters club. That's the year, of course, that the club was founded. And tonight, I understand as well that John Temple may even address the supporters this evening. So that'll be interesting.
Sounds like there's a bit of positivity after such a dark period. But Tony, do you think, I know that you mentioned the checks and balances will be done, but just when you look at this whole saga over the last few days, can you see it happening again? Or are the League of Ireland going to move on from this and learn?
I'd love to say we've learned our lesson, but, you know, I can remember Cork City for me having to become a co-op, the supporters-run club. Monaghan went out of business in 2016. You know, it's happened time and time and time again. And, you know, if clubs live beyond their means, you know, it could conceivably happen again. Hopefully not. I mean, outside of this Dundalk issue, and there's been so many league tables with asterisks on them, and I hope we don't see that this season, and I hope we never see it again. But, you know, will clubs learn their lesson? I think the league has been in a healthier state until this Dundalk situation came to mind. Stephen McGuinness pointed out at the AGM at the weekend as well that, you know, it's been 7 years since there was an issue with any club in terms of their wages, etc. So, you know, and 12 years since the club went out of business. So hopefully Dundalk won't go out of business, that they will survive, and we'll see the end of these sort of stories.
Okay, Tony, thank you so much for bringing us up to speed on all of that. Really appreciate you taking the time. Now to the Champions League. There's a couple of games already underway. Juventus
feels wrong, doesn't it, speaking of the Champions League after Dundalk.
Well, to be honest now, I think I'm happy enough with the early games, Paul. I always like the early games. Juventus 2, PSV 0, and Aston Villa have taken the lead against Young Boys, Paul.
They have indeed. It was a well-worked corner. Quick, short corner to John McGinn. John McGinn stands the ball up to Yuri Tielemans at the back post. Takes a really good first touch and buries it into the bottom corner. But it's been a very open game. And it's going to be interesting to see this new format with all the chops and changes with results, given that it's a league format, and see how it plays out. But plenty of goals in the first two games.
Yeah.
What do you make of the new format, Paul?
I don't know, Ruby, I guess, until we really get into it. But obviously, more games and teams won't be playing against the same opposition twice. I think that is definitely something to look forward to. And we probably get more of the top teams playing against each other, and I think the more the top teams are playing against each other, the better product. But the Champions League, it didn't feel broken, I didn't think, in the last couple of years. I think we had some amazing, particularly knockout games. Real Madrid kind of spring to mind, and Man City when they went on to win the competition. But I think just give it time and see how it pans out. The players certainly aren't happy with the extra fixtures that have come about, but I think we'll get some really good games.
I think the knockout phases are pretty much going to still be the same. Obviously, the top eight teams in the league will get a bye into the last 16, and then the teams that finish between 9th and 24th will play off for those other eight places. So the knockout part should be the same as it was. Mm. It looks like they've tried to reinvent the group stages to make them a bit more interesting. But this format could do that, couldn't it?
Yeah, it could do. You would imagine that the teams, particularly in Pot 3 and Pot 4, might pick up a couple more points, given that they're going to play a couple more games against one another. But for the top tier teams, it is all about playing and finishing in those top eight positions, because what they don't want, I mean, you can hear the players and the fan, or the players and the clubs giving out about the fixture congestion. What they don't want to do is finish between 9 and 24 and having to play another two games. I think it's the other side of Christmas, which would really kind of pack up the fixtures for those sides. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see. I mean, like, I still feel like we'll end up with the same 4 to 6 teams at kind of tail end of the competition that you could say, okay, have a realistic chance of winning it. But maybe the points will be evenly spread, I guess, more around those top or tier 3 and tier 4 sides.
Mark Langton of the Racing Post is with us as well. Mark, we know the players aren't mad about it. Fans aren't really sure yet. What do the media think?
Well, I think media split, really. There are some people that I think are just confused by it. I mean, it's not something that we're used to in terms of football, you know, not playing against the same teams. I personally, in favour of trying something else, the Champions League had kind of been, what, 20 years roughly in the same format. I think the last 4 or 5 years, the group stage was beginning to feel tired. It felt to me like the same teams kept on playing each other. You won't get that as much anymore. It does mean that more top teams will play against more top teams. If you think back to sort of the previous era, a team in pot one would not play another team in pot one. At least with this format, you get two games against sort of, you know, their fellow heavyweights. And I also think it gives the smaller sort of leagues and teams more of a chance of qualifying. You'd sometimes get groups and you kind of felt like you knew they'd finish 1, 2, 3, 4 in sort of order, you know, before a ball was kicked. This time around, I'm looking at somebody like Celtic, who really struggled in the Champions League. Obviously, a big team domestically, but struggled in Europe. The sort of common belief is that you'll need around about 9 points to finish between 9th and 24th. So if you're to finish 24th, you might need, sort of roughly speaking, 9 points. That feels achievable for Celtic. You know, that the home games that they've got, and when I've sort of seen them in like the last decade in the Champions League, it never really felt like they were sort of in it to do, to progress so much. So I do think that it kind of gives a lot of teams that next level an opportunity to aim for something. So I feel like the Champions League was broken, so I'm all for giving it another go and seeing if this works.
Okay, well, as I mentioned, the players aren't too happy about it. We heard Alisson yesterday say nobody cares what they think. Let's hear what Rodri had to say. He was speaking to the media today.
Hiya, Rodri. There's been quite a lot of talk about the amount of games that players are playing at the moment with the expanded Champions League. Obviously, you've got the Club World Cup next summer. In your mind, because you've been quite outspoken about it as well, in your mind, how many games a season do you think is an optimum level for an elite player to play?
Honestly, I don't know the exact number. I think from my experience, I can tell you that 60, 70 now, obviously. I think between 40 and 50 is the amount of games in which a player can perform in the highest level. After that, everything comes, you drop, because it's impossible to sustain the physical level. And yeah, and I think this year we're going to go until 70, maybe 80. Depends on how far you go into competitions. In my humble opinion, I think it's too much. I think we have to take care of ourselves. Someone has to take care of ourselves, because we are the main characters of this, let's say, sport or business, whatever you want to call it. And yeah, I think not everything is money or marketing. It's also the quality of the show. So, in my opinion, when I'm rest, when I'm not tired, I perform better. And if the people want to see a better football, we need to rest. Just something to put in there. But that's what I think.
Mark, the players are starting to speak out about it now, and who knows what will happen if they do decide to come together. But do you feel there could be trouble coming down the track with the amount of commitments they have?
I feel like that they're definitely, you know, there are more injuries and the product's not as good. I think the Euros was, it didn't light up, did it, the summer from a kind of spectacle point of view. I agree with a lot there with what Rodri said. The only way it could change is if the players got together and went on strike. I would say that feels very unlikely. And you know, the only reason there are more games is because, you know, ultimately the people that run football, UEFA, FIFA, but then the clubs want more money, you know, to pay the players. So it is a vicious circle. I'm sure the players wouldn't want to take. I mean, Rodri was sort of talking there that he can't play 70 games. So, you know, he thinks 40 to 50 is optimal. Is he prepared to take a pay cut of that percentage to not play? Are the other players probably not? What I quite liked was Carlo Ancelotti was speaking about this, and his plan is to try to give players a break during the season, almost like an annual leave, like holiday, like a, you know, an office worker would take. And he thinks that is a more sensible approach. So I wonder if you will see more and more teams resting and rotating. I definitely feel like there is too much football. If you look at the calendar, there feels like there's a game every midweek now, you know, particularly for the international players. But I haven't got a solution because everybody wants more money. You know, the TV companies want more games. You know, the clubs want more money. The players want more money. So I'm not sure what the solution is, but I definitely feel like it is harmful to the overall product.
That is the economics, though, Mark. If you go back 30 years, 20 teams in the first division, if you got a good run in the cup, it was still six games. That was 44 games. But most games were Saturday afternoon. And if it was a Wednesday, they were divided better. Now, with the way television has gone, to pay the wages and to keep funding the clubs, you're playing Sunday games, Monday games, Friday games. There's no set difference between the amount of days you can have off.
I agree with that. I mean, obviously the squads are bigger now than what they were then. I mean, you can get five substitutes now, you know, on the pitch at one time. I think managers are kind of using the science available to them and rotating when players are in kind of what was in that fatigue zone. I'm not sure there isn't an easy solution to it. I mean, the one thing I would say is that I think that this FIFA World Club Cup thing at the end of this season is a joke competition, really. I mean, it's been extended, you know, way beyond what it used to be. Doesn't appear to be any real qualifying criteria for it. It's for the European teams, pretty pointless most of the games. I mean, they're so much better than everybody else. Kevin De Bruyne says that I think there's only going to be 3 weeks break between the final of that World Club Cup and the start of the next Premier League season. So I feel like that's probably you know, one too many. I don't think we needed to extend the Champions League. I think you could have still done this league format and played six games rather than eight. So I think there are ways that you can help. In the Premier League, it's particularly profound because there are two cup competitions. I don't I don't think there's another top team, a top league in Europe, sorry, that has two cup competitions. So I feel like the sort of EFL Cup could come under pressure. There's a 20-team league in the Premier League. A lot of the sort of European leagues now are sort of 18 teams, so there's fewer matches there. I think we are looking at it very much, I think, from it feels like it's a bigger problem in England because you've got the two cups and you've got 20 teams. And it also feels like every Premier League game is absolutely huge. I watched Bayern Munich at the weekend and, you know, they absolutely strolled to victory against Holstein Kiel. And then you watch Man City play Brentford and it's more of a dogfight for them and they can only win 2-1. So I think that there's a lot of issues. There are solutions in terms of, you know, just maybe getting rid of a domestic cup competition. But I know there'd be a lot of people in sort of English football that would be furious if you got rid of even a cup competition like that that's not as popular as the FA Cup.
Paul, Aston Villa have doubled their lead in what was probably the most chaotic goal I've ever seen.
Well, we're talking about the top teams in Europe being involved in this competition. I mean, this second goal was like something from the Phoenix Park. Centre-half intercepts the ball in his six-yard box, turns around to lay the ball back to his goalkeeper. A blind pass, doesn't look. Ollie Watkins steps in to intercept the ball. The keeper takes a big chunk out of Watkins. Ball falls to Jacob Ramsey, 2 yards out.
Yeah, Watkins fell on the ball first as well.
Ramsey had a bit of work to do to take the ball from underneath Ollie Watkins and scores from 2 yards out. So they're in dreamland. They actually could have been 3-0 ahead. They had a really good chance there in 40 minutes. Ramsey again to put the game to bed, but they're playing well, Marie.
It's a bit of a mad game though, isn't it?
It is, because young boys have actually had chances of their own and it's been very open and very end to end. But Villa looking in cruise control, and with Unai Emery in charge and his experience in European competitions, you would expect that Villa would do quite well.
Mark, of the later games this evening, Liverpool are in Milan, 8 o'clock kickoff. I mean, if you think of Liverpool and Milan, you think of the 2005 final, 3-0 down, ended up 4-3 to Liverpool on the night, did it?
3-3, and then they won on penalties. 3-3, yeah. That miracle night in Istanbul. I would say definitely the Milan team that will take to the pitch tonight is not as good as that one. You might say the same about sort of, it depends, in some areas Liverpool might be stronger. That midfield that Liverpool had was absolutely fantastic. But yeah, the Milan team that had Kaká in it, it's not like that anymore. I think their biggest threat comes down the left-hand side. Rafael Leao, very quick. Teo Hernandez, the left-back, likes to get forward. So they'll look to attack down that side as much as possible. But defensively, they've been absolute shambles this season. I think they're still trying to adjust to the new manager, Paulo Fonseca. So Liverpool will fancy their chances of scoring at San Siro. Should be a good watch. One of the Milan players, Emerson Royale, who arrived from Tottenham, has had a particularly tough time since he moved to Italy. So, yeah, good opportunity for Liverpool to get some goals, a bit like Aston Villa tonight as well.
They've got a third, Paul Corrie.
Yeah, they have Ollie Watkins on the score sheet now, and it's come down the left-hand side again. Jacob Ramsey pulls a ball back, and Ollie Watkins' first attempt gets blocked by the centre-half, but he does well to just get it out of his feet and stick it beyond the goalkeeper. So it's important for Ollie Watkins. He had a bit of a dry patch towards the end of the Premier League season last year. He was on the score sheet on the weekend and again tonight. So really, that should be game, set and match for Aston Villa. Right. Back to the Liverpool. Like, it's one thing Rodri coming out and saying that he's tired of playing all the games. Alisson stands between the sticks for Liverpool.
You can give Kelleher a go if he wants. He's mad for game time anyway. If he's that worried about his games, Alisson. Mark, there are 6 games tonight. The other 3, Bayern Munich, Dynamo Zagreb. Munich are flying, aren't they?
Oh, they've started the season really well. Vincent Kompany needed it. It was a surprise choice as manager. Kane, scoring plenty of goals as well. So, I mean, this should be a routine home win, I would have thought, for Bayern.
Real Madrid, Stuttgart. Wouldn't fancy Stuttgart's trip.
No, Real Madrid haven't perhaps clicked into full gear yet with Kylian Mbappe sort of still finding his way into the team. But Stuttgart finished second in the Bundesliga last season. But they've lost, as always is the case, I suppose, with these surprise teams that sort of rise through the league. All of their best players have left in the summer. So this probably is a step too far for them.
And Sporting Lisbon are flying, and Lille can't get a kick in League One. So I'm going with Sporting Lisbon.
Yeah, I would have thought home advantage would be good here for Sporting. Scoring plenty of goals. And I'd agree. Yeah.
Paul, just before we finish up, it's only 2-0 now.
Yeah, disallowed. VAR have ruled it out for handball. That ball, the initial strike that Ollie Watkins had, hit the defender, came back, and I actually thought it was harsh. I thought it hit more his chest and his stomach area than his hand for controlling the ball, but referee saw differently.
Okay, it's half time in that other game, Juventus 2 PSV. Now we'll be keeping an eye on them for the rest of the hour. Mark Langdon, thank you so much as always for chatting to us. We're going to take a really quick break, and when we're back, we'll be talking to boxer Thomas Carty about his big fight this weekend.
Game on 2FM.
Welcome back. We are turning our attention to boxing, and I'm delighted to say that we have Thomas Carty in studio with us. And Thomas has a really big fight on Friday. And the good thing about you, Thomas, is you seem to win all your fights.
This is it. Yeah, it's been good, a good going so far, 8-0.
And done it in style?
In style. Barring my debut, I've knocked everybody out that I fought, yeah.
And that's great, okay? You're knocking everybody out, but does that mean it's really hard to get people to want to fight you? And also, from your own perspective, do you learn more from harder fights?
Yeah, it can be difficult to get an opponent, and you know, it all comes down to the budget for fights and stuff like that now, and whether it can be squeezed in. But luckily enough, my last couple of fights have been on massive cards. You know, the Three Arena twice for Katie Taylor on the cards, and now this one here this weekend on Callum Walters on the cards. So luckily enough, it's on these big, massive cards that have the budget to allow me to fight on them.
I was at those two in the Three Arena, and one thing that I noticed was you have huge support.
Yeah, I have a massive crowd. I will always have a massive crowd, even from my amateur days, but especially now since turning pro, the gang is growing all the time.
Yeah. Huge support.
Yeah.
It's huge arms. His arms are the size of me quads here.
Maybe it's a pity you're not here now, because we'd be measuring you up.
Very different, a jockey to a heavyweight. Says the fair chance they'd have been quiet if I was in the studio tonight, Marie. But look, just looking at it, turning pro, Thomas, if reading your own quotes, you fell into it. You fell into boxing. This wasn't a career you grew up in or a sport you even grew up in.
No. I would always preach that I wasn't like born to fight like most people would preach, and the cliche, you know, born fighter and stuff like that. No, I played Gaelic football first, yeah. I played soccer actually, then Gaelic football.
Okay, tell us a bit more about that. So like, what position were you? Who did you play for? How interested were you in them?
Started off playing soccer, took it fairly serious, found Gaelic football through a friend in school. I'm from Phibsborough, but then ended up playing for Scully Cunnell in Clontarf. So don't ask me how or why, we ended up there. And played midfield most of the time, yeah. I was tall and skinny and could run. And then I slowly put the weight on through the years. But that's up until about 16, 17. And then the boxing took off, and the rest was history from boxing. Got really good really quick, and I had to leave the Gaelic football to the side.
Okay, so how does boxing just take off?
So it's in a team sport. And like I said, Scully Cunnell weren't the most popular club at the time, with the big ones, Clontarf and Vincent. So the team was made up of some lads were playing, you know, for some lads from the younger teams are playing for us and weren't taking it, like the team wasn't being taken so serious. And then I found boxing. A guy, Christopher Conway, brought me to the boxing club, and in my first year I won an Irish title, and I kicked off. That's how it kicked off. I got really good fairly fast, and national teams and captain European squads and stuff like that.
That's amazing.
Obviously you turned professional then. You went to the UK to turn professional. You got in with SOS Management, David Hay, a few other people have influenced your career. But reading you again, you fight because you box because you like it, rather you fight because you want to rather than you have to.
Correct.
Is that a fair way of putting it?
Yeah, no, absolutely. That would be a right way of putting it. I'd like to class myself as someone who's half intelligent, and I don't think I don't have to box. You know, I wouldn't be homeless in the morning if I wasn't boxing, you know what I mean? But I love what I do at the moment, because the only pressure that's on myself is the pressure I put on myself, and the only pressure I have is the pressure I allow myself.
How much pressure is that?
A lot at the moment, you know, a lot. But as I said, you know, I allow it myself, and if I wanted to quit tomorrow, I could quit, but I won't be stopping anytime soon.
And what would you do
tomorrow? I don't know, get a job like this, maybe on the radio or something.
When there was like Paul Carty talking about football.
Go back, you say pressure, like, as much as you allow to put on yourself. What is the pressure you're putting on yourself? What are the aims?
Well, like
financially, life, you have a partner. What are the pressures you're putting on yourself?
Well, you have to imagine, I'm professional boxing full time nearly 4 years now, and I have friends having kids, buying houses and stuff like that, and you know, they all have security of a guaranteed wage. If I was to break my arm tomorrow, there's no one going to start throwing wages at me. You have to fight for my money, you know. have to fight to get paid, and I have to fight to secure a future for myself. And I'm intelligent enough to know that if I stick at this for long enough, I can secure a fairly comfortable future and probably not have to work ever again. But you know, there's a couple of risky years ahead, but nothing that I'm not willing to go through and put myself through.
In ways, Ruby, it's probably a bit like you when you were riding. Like, you're going out, getting up every morning. You have to do it for yourself. You have to secure the rides. You have to get the wins. You have to be better.
Yeah, you're out for a riding fee. You're out for a winning percentage. It was no work, no pay. It was the very, very same mentality. And you could never earn enough as a jockey that you're never going to work again. Obviously, you get into the elite level of boxing,
and done something over there.
Unfortunately, that was flat racing. It just didn't really work for me, Marie. But you look at it, Thomas. You say you could get into the realms that you could earn enough that you could never have to work again.
We'll never have to worry about money again, yeah? I'd never have to worry.
Is that a realistic achievement, or is that just a dream?
No, it's realistic. As I said, you know, I wouldn't still be at this game. I've seen the glitz and glamour. I've hung around AJ and your Tyson Furies and the guys at the top of the food chain. And I've seen, you know, I'm 86, ranked 86 in the world. There's not a million miles between me and the top guys in the sport and the money that's knocking around. And it is something that I can see myself achieving. Otherwise, I'd have no problem. I'm proud enough to say, right, Tom, you're not good enough. Off you go, get a job, or go work for your dad. You know what I mean?
How do you end up going in, being a sparring partner for the likes of Anthony Joshua or Tyson Fury and them?
Stylistically, I would match up with the characteristics of Alexander Usyk, who's currently undisputed champion. So anybody who's ever fought against him, their teams, the camps would get in contact with me. Hi, Thomas, are you available to come train with us? We'd really like to have you over. And then
What's the characteristics?
A left-handed, athletic, fast, good technique, good solid foundation. So if the likes of these guys are calling you, you're obviously doing something right.
There's obviously a bonus in that too. If you're sparring with Joshua and Tyson Fury, surely it's improving you.
Absolutely, it's a double whammy. You're getting paid for the work that you're doing, and then you're seeing when it's like at the very top of the game that you're trying to achieve something in. So yeah, it's a double whammy, definitely.
So when you go to spar with them, does that mean, obviously sparring is you're in the ring fighting with them, but do you get to train full stop with them, or do you just get dragged into
some spar? People are different, but I've trained with an awful lot of heavyweights, and in terms of the ones I've trained with, Anthony Joshua and Tyson Fury have been more receptive to me training with them. And yeah, we train full time, do all the sessions and pair up, whether it's running or sparring or in the weight room, you know what I mean? We do it all the same.
Has to be a huge benefit.
Massive benefit, absolutely. And especially in the boxing world, it's improving your network as well. A lot more people are getting to know who I am from the exposure, being around these top guys who are, you know, they're on the Mount Rushmore of boxing at the moment. So you couldn't be around much better people, to be completely honest.
When we talk about footballers and being left-sided or left-footed, they're always rare, and you say you can add an extra 20,000 onto their fee or whatever it is. Is it a rare thing to be a left-handed boxer?
It seems to be. I can't name that many, especially heavyweights. It's rare enough to be left-handed, but it's even more rare to be a left-handed heavyweight.
Is there advantages?
Not so much advantage. It's not like having an extra hand, but it's it's a little bit rarer, you know. So right-handers aren't used to dealing with left-handers probably as much, whereas left-handers have always fought against right-handers, if that makes sense.
These are things I've never thought about before.
Yeah. This is
it does make perfect sense.
Yeah, it does. It really
what about
does.
The weekend?
This weekend, this Friday night for me.
Yeah.
Expecting another big, massive KO. You know, everybody else is expecting, and there's real hype building now. Since yesterday, I've been doing a lot of media, and there's a lot of people talking online, and a lot of boxing critics are out for me, and they're expecting something big from me.
And
rightly so, as well. There's been a lot of hype building for a long time, and this is my third outing at the Three Arena, so roll on Friday.
And a big night for Callum as well, and the homecoming.
Massive night for Callum. And I think it's really going to be something special to see, because Katie Taylor's opened the floodgates for boxing in Ireland again. Here we are, fair play to Tom Loeffler and UFC Fight Pass, because they're putting on this show for us, and look at the opportunity that we're getting.
You say there's people out for you, the media, people online, etc. Obviously you're reading it, if you know that there.
Yeah.
And B, that spur you on, inspire you, motivate you, aggravate you?
Spurs me on. Everybody's going to have an opinion, you know, everybody's going to have an opinion. And if you, I'm not too sure, I'd say you've heard a few coarse words about yourself in your time as well, Ruby, but
I give up listening to it. That's why I'm asking.
Not on social media anymore,
but I've seen a fair few, and if you'd listened to them, I'd have retired a long time ago. So I do my own thing. Everybody's going to talk, you know, everyone has an opinion. It's just one of those things.
What's the trajectory then for you? What happens? What happens over the next 12 months, 24 months? What's the plans?
At the moment, though, I'm a free agent, promotional free agent. So I'm in a really powerful position. I haven't pledged my allegiance anywhere in particular. So I'm looking forward to having this fight. It will get me to 9-0, hopefully 8 knockouts in a row. And we will see. We will see. I'm in a very interesting point in my career where I'm on the cusp of something big. You know, I could take a really big opportunity, hopefully try and get into some of the Saudi money and Saudi fights. We shall see. We shall see. And boxing is crazy because a lot can happen in a week, never mind a year or 12 months. A lot can happen in a week. So we shall see. Like to fight again, maybe before Christmas and then St. Patrick's Day next year, hopefully in Madison Square Garden, New York.
A lot can happen in sport in a week. You know, it's no different there, boxing. That's just sport in general. But you say you have a plan and you're a free agent. Winning the weekend, does that elevate you? Where, how much would that elevate you in the world rankings? How many fights would you be from a payday? A proper one.
A proper payday. 8-9-0. Probably 3 or 4. I'd say one more year of building away from taking a chance. One more year of building. So, you know, 2, 3, 4 fights max away from having a crack at it and throwing my name in the hat with the big boys.
And tell us this, when you get that hat chucked in the ring for the big boys and it's all on Dan Zen and one of them, will you come and talk to us?
You'll have to speak to my agent.
It's DAZN, Ruby.
Yeah. Oh, wow. You'll have to speak to Rebecca Evans. You'll have to speak to my agent, absolutely.
It was great to have you in. Just, we'll get your opinion on this because we are talking about footballers here, and Paul Corrie is a former professional footballer there, and they're giving out about having to play all these extra tournaments.
Poor fellas.
So we have a text in here, Paul Corrie. This is, I'd say, aimed at you. Players get days off after every game. At most, they go in for a light stretch. Some lads are on 300 grand a week. Toughen up, lads. It's a short career. Put up, shut up, get on with it. You can sleep when you retire.
I certainly wasn't on 300
grand a week.
That was Ruby said it.
You can understand it.
Yeah, look, they do have short careers.
It's easy to say from the outside. I'm sure there's a lot more to it when you're involved. You know, that's coming from a sportsman. I could probably send the message like that as well, but you're not a footballer. Whoever that isn't a footballer, obviously.
No. Very hard to have sympathy for footballers, though.
You see, you can say that when you're a boxer.
You're a jockey. Like, yeah, it's a different way of life.
I mean to the texter who texts it in.
Thomas, thank you so much for coming in. Best of luck on Friday. We'll be keeping an eye on you from now and forevermore. And hopefully we'll get to see you at some stage again. And hopefully you'll come back in and speak to us too. We're going to take another break. Stay with us. We'll be keeping an eye on all of these Champions League games. And we're also going to be talking to Neil Tracy about all the latest rugby news.
Game on 2FM.
Now, it's been a busy day in the world of rugby, so Neil Tracy of RT Sport joins us to talk us through all of the big stories. So what's bigger, Neil? Munster have a new captain, the Ireland women's squad was named, the interim coach for the Ireland team. Lots going on.
There is a lot going on, Marie. Hard to believe we're only a few days into the season, really. This season has taken off with a bang today. I suppose, will we start with the Simon Easterby news? I suppose it's one of these things where a lot of what's happened today is news, but I suppose none of it has come as a particular shock. We knew Tadhg Byrne was more than likely going to be captain. We more than likely knew that Simon Easterby was going to be put in interim charge. But I suppose now it lays out the plan for Irish rugby for the season, where we know Andy Farrell is going to be in place till after the autumn internationals. And then from December, Simon Easterby is going to take it up while Farrell is away with the Lions. Also tomorrow, of course, as well, we'll have the emerging Ireland squad, where Simon Easterby is going to be delivering his squad that he's going to be bringing off to South Africa in a couple of weeks as well. So we'll get an opportunity tomorrow to hear what Simon Easterby has to say about what's in store for him over a busy year.
It'll be a busy year for Simon Easterby, but why does Andy Farrell have to go missing for the Six Nations? I mean, the Lions tour is not till next summer.
Yeah, I know, Ruby, but it is one of those things that's happened a lot. We would have seen it with Warren Gatland down the years when he was doing the gig while he was still with Wales, and he would have had someone like Rob Howley stepping in as his interim head coach. And while on paper it obviously doesn't seem ideal, it is one of these things where you can get something quite good out of it from an IRFU point of view, where if you look at Simon Easterby's CV, he's been around this squad for a long time, first as a player, then as a forwards coach, and now more recently in the last few years doing defence. And this is a huge opportunity for the IRVU to be able to see what is someone like Simon Easterby, what is he like when he's promoted into the top job, and to be able to give him a bit of a trial run, have a look under the bonnet of see how things work, and potentially in a few years' time, if there was a big provincial gig to come up, or if tomorrow morning, if Andy Farrell decided that he wanted a change of scenery and wanted to leave an Ireland job permanently, that there's a bit of a succession plan in place. So there is a lot that Ireland can get out of it, even though it's, I suppose, not ideal to be losing someone like Andy Farrell.
Yep, that's a fair way of looking at it. A different way I hadn't looked at it.
Yeah, I guess it'll depend, though. What's that? It'll depend how it goes. Like, that's the other side of it. Like, it's not...
Of course.
Yeah, like, things aren't... Like, you know, it hasn't all been plain sailing in the last while.
It hasn't, but look, like... I think Simon Easterby deserves, I think everyone deserves to see what he is like in the job, and he would deserve to get a chance at it as well. And I think as well, it probably helps keep a coach like him there, because, you know, as I said, he's been involved with this team for pretty much 10 years as a coach, and he might be getting itchy feet himself to be promoted to a top man somewhere else. I'm sure there have been clubs in the last few years that have got in touch with him about trying to sound him out to see if he was interested. And, you know, if he thinks that potentially there is an opportunity for him to one day step up and be an Ireland head coach, that might keep him as part of Andy Farrell's backroom team or happy to be involved and to scratch that itch just for the time being as well.
Fair enough. What about Munster then? Tadhg Byrne, it was probably the best, worst kept secret in rugby.
It was, yeah. Look, I mean, since the early days of last season when Peter O'Mahony confirmed he was stepping down as Munster captain. Tadhg Byrne, it wasn't officially confirmed he was the new captain, but week on week when his name was on the team sheet with the C beside it, we knew it was coming. And it's funny, what I think is a really, really good choice about it. First of all, he's always come across as a very good talker. He leads by example on the pitch as well, but I think it's a great example for... Exactly, Ruby, exactly. But also I think what's really nice is the message it actually sends out. If you look at his career, he's had to go about his career the hard way. He didn't get through with the Leinster Academy. He went off to Wales. He was a late bloomer, and eventually he came back to Ireland in his late 20s and has had this career renaissance to where he's now one of the best second row / back rows in world rugby. And I think for younger players, not so much just what he's doing day on day, week on week, but to look at the story that he's had is probably a very, very inspiring thing as well.
There's a little bit of interference coming in there. I presume it's from you, Neil, but anyway, we'll keep on moving.
Sounds like Siri, doesn't it?
Yeah, or else you're on a train or something like that. You're making lots of good points, because that's a really good one about Tadhg Byrne, and he has had one of those careers that hasn't been straightforward, and great to see somebody getting the reward. So Scott Beamant has named his 30-player squad for Ireland's WXV1 campaign in Vancouver. They had that great victory on Saturday over Australia, but they have some really tough games to come, Neil.
They do, and like as good as things were on Saturday, Marie, and as good as they were for large chunks of the Six Nations as well, I think it would be important to probably just temper expectations over the next few weeks. And the players and coaches have been honest enough to say it themselves in recent weeks, where, you know, Wales were in this situation similar to Ireland this time a year ago, where they were promoted to or started out in WXV1 and were going up against teams that on paper were a lot better than them. And 6-7 months later, when it came to the Six Nations, it obviously hit their confidence more than we expected it would, and they seem to have regressed a little bit. So I think for Ireland, it's not about looking at what are the three results that they get out of this WXV campaign. It's that when they head to the World Cup in 12 months' time, are they a better team than they are now? And to learn the lessons along the way, because look, it's obvious New Zealand and Canada are better teams than Ireland at the moment. But Ireland are a developing team. They're getting good depth in. They have basically a free shot now because they have their World Cup qualification already sorted, where they can use this next 12 months to get caps and get minutes into the legs of these players. And I think they just need to go out there and enjoy the whole experience of it.
But this squad looks like one that they plan to develop. I mean, there's four uncapped players, four players who got their first cap last Saturday. That's 8 of the 32, or 8 of the 30 even. At least they're bringing players to try and get them through.
They are, Ruby, and what's been really interesting, I, in my opinion personally, in the last 6 months, and more so even since watching the Women's Interpro Championship early on in the summer, we're seeing a lot more young players coming through now in the women's game in Ireland, and who are, what I'd kind of say is, like, moving like rugby players. When they're carrying the ball, they look like people who've been playing rugby since the age of, you know, 8, 9 or 10, whereas maybe 15 years ago, when there were quality women's rugby players coming through, a lot of those would have, you know, converted to the game in their late teens or early 20s. But you can see now, like, someone like Aoife Wafer, obviously, who's become a superstar in the last 12 months, when she's running with the ball, she looks like someone who has been running with a rugby ball for so long. So there's definitely a lot of really, really good talent coming through in Ireland at the moment. And you can see that these players have been playing rugby for a long time as well.
Yep, it's all about patience now for the next while. Neil Tracy, thank you so much, as always, for coming on and chatting to us. Before we finish up, Paul, anything happening in the Champions League?
No, still 2-0 to Aston Villa. The Liverpool team is in, though. Alisson in goal, Tsimikas, Konate, Van Dijk, Trent, Gravenberch, McAllister, Gakpo, Szoboszlai, Salah and Diogo Jota. So what that means is Gakpo and Tsimikas in for Diaz and Robertson, and Federico Chiesa on the bench for the first time.
Oh, exciting.
Well, that's nice. I need to give a few lads a rest there, make sure they can get to the rest of the game. This year. It's good to see him. Yeah, thanks, Paul Curry. I think that's all we've got time for, Marie, isn't it?
It is, yeah. I'm back tomorrow, and we have another boxer in. We've Emmett Brennan, so do tune in for that. And yeah, that's it from us.